Hi, welcome to True Creeps, where the stories are true and the creeps are real. We'll cover stories from grotesque gore to the possibly plausible paranormal, to horrifying history, to tense and terrible true crime, and everything else that goes bump in the night. We're your hosts, Amanda,
and I'm Lindsay, and we want you to join us while we creep.
We cover mature topics. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello, everyone. Today, we are going to be discussing a cold case out of my home state, Arizona, from 2003. So it's been a while. This one caught my attention because it involves some strange photographs. And this one was actually sent to us by Nora. So thank you, Nora. This was interesting to look at.
The photographs are unnerving.
They are. And I'm sure I've said it a million times on here. I'm obsessed with cameras, right? So as soon as Nora sent me this, I was like, oh, after seeing the photographs, I have to look into this case for me anyway. So I'm like, we're going to do an episode on it because it's wild.
Yeah.
Now, the case is so heartbreaking, especially because it's a cold case. So the poor family never had this resolved. So let's first talk about our two victims. Their names were Lisa Guerreri and Brandon Rumbaugh. The two were dating, but some sources say that they were recently engaged and that they were celebrating their 1-year anniversary when they were murdered.
I hate that.
Me too. And they were babies, right? So Lisa was born on July 14th of 1984, and she was only 19 years old at the time. She was working for SRP as a secretary, and that's a power company out here. She graduated from Mesa High School, and she was a sophomore at Mesa Community College studying business management. I also saw somewhere that she eventually wanted to be a wedding planner because she was inspired by the film The Wedding Planner, which I thought was cute.
I love that.
She enjoyed singing, and she sang with a band at Christ the King Catholic Church. And according to her friends and family, she was loved by everyone who knew her, and she had no enemies. Her mother said that she was beautiful inside and out. And her uncle, Mike, said that she was the type of person that could walk in a room when you're ticked off or upset, and then you couldn't help but smile because she always had a big smile on her face.
Hmm.
So just like a warm person, right?
Yeah.
Another memory that he had shared is that she sang at his wedding.
That's so sweet.
So she was like very talented too.
Yeah.
Lisa's father, unfortunately, his name was John, died about a year and a half before she died. And he died on May 29th of 2002. And so her uncle Mike had mentioned that the last thing that her father heard before he died was Lisa singing. And then after her father's passing, she got really close with her uncle. And he said in a few interviews that she was like one of his own.
So Brandon was born on May 7th of 1983, and he was 20 years old. He graduated from Coronado High School in 2001.
Now, that was our rival high school when I was in high school. So I likely know some of the people that went to high school with him. Like, I'm still friends with people from Coronado.
When you say rival, was it like sports rival or?
Yeah, yeah. Like, I wasn't into the sports, obviously, but
the sports.
That was a thing. Yeah.
Brandon worked as a personal trainer at a gym in Mesa, and he attended Arizona State University. He was also in the United States Marine Reserves. He had dreams of opening his own gym one day. I love they both had big dreams. They were like, this is what I want. Because sometimes, like, when you're that age, you're like, something that just hurts my heart so much. So he's a jock, right? But Brandon also loved all kinds of art. He painted and sculpted. He danced in some large productions, and he even played drums in a local band. He had a great sense of humor. His friends and family said that he was goofy and fun-loving. Brandon's friends, after he died, created a scholarship fund in his name.
That was very sweet.
I think that's a beautiful way of honoring someone. So Brandon and Lisa lived in Scottsdale, Arizona. Lisa's mom, Paula, said that Brandon treated her daughter like a queen, and their friends said that they were both very happy together. So on Friday, October 17th of 2003, the two set out to go camping up north in Arizona. They originally wanted to go to Disneyland, but it was a bit too pricey. So they went to Bumblebee Road off of the 17.
I've passed that area a ton of times. It's pretty remote and it's just desert all around. But there's like some camping areas nearby. And typically you go past that area, like to go up to the northern cities and stuff. But it's not somewhere that I would ever really think to stop. But I guess a lot of people like do ATVs and stuff like that.
Oh, that makes sense. And then just as a note, since 2003, there has been some reconstruction in that area. So it doesn't look quite the same as when they were there, but it is still relatively remote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's not much out there. Now, Lisa had never gone camping before, and her mom was a little worried because they asked about borrowing her truck. And she was like, I don't know. It needs an oil change. Not sure about that. But she ended up letting them. Their plan was to sleep in the back of the truck and then be back by 9 a.m. the next morning. So it's just like a quick overnight trip just to hang out, watch the stars, come home. The truck was a white Ford F-150. And then again, Lisa's mom was like, yes, I guess you can borrow it, but be home in the morning. Now, Lisa told her aunt and her mom not to tell her Uncle Mike about the trip, as she knew that he would never let her go. And remember, they were close after her father passed, so he was like her father figure, and he kept her safe. Mike did an interview a few years back talking about how he didn't know that she was going up there and that he wouldn't have ever let Lisa go there. He mentioned that the area is dangerous, as many people go up there to party, and then some of them bring guns up there. And he knew that because he had done the same. He had gone out over there to party before, so he's like, I don't want her near that crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And for anyone not in Arizona, I don't know if it's like that everywhere, but that's like a typical teenager thing too out here, is like if you want to have like a little party in the desert, like far away, because no one can like stop it easily. So that's like a thing that we do here.
I mean, I think that there's some version of that everywhere. What I think of that type of situation, that's like teenagers, right? It's people who are being young and dumb, not people who are nefarious. So I think it's one thing to be like, oh, I'm going to go camping in this place where people around my age hang out, versus I'm going to go to a place where there is criminal activity that is nefarious, not just reckless. There's a little bit of a difference there.
That's true. It's just, it's a little scary, as like when you go into the middle of the desert here, a lot of people do go shooting. And so like if you're kind of in a remote area and they're shooting and they don't know that you're there, that's a little scary. And there's a lot of reckless people out there. So like I see where he's coming from. Like, honestly, no one should go out in the desert here because it's dangerous for a number of reasons, including critters and things. But I felt bad because he mentioned that it crushed him ever since, because like he didn't get to stop her.
Yeah.
Not his fault, obviously, but it just sucks.
That is very sad.
So on their way up, Lisa's mom, Paula, called to check on them. And she was like, are you guys there yet? And Lisa said, no, we're still driving. We're X amount of miles away. So typical, normal conversation. Paula ended it with, you know, be careful. I love you. All of that. And then that was the last phone call that they ever had.
The idea of the last phone call just hurts the heart.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, the next morning, Brandon did not show up for work and Lisa didn't go home. So her mom got worried. Paula later said it was mother's instinct that kicked in, and she knew something was wrong. She called Mike about 10 to 15 minutes after 9 a.m. because Lisa was always punctual. And when she wasn't going to be on time, she would call. So her just not showing up, especially when she'd borrowed her mother's truck, was bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
So Paula called Lisa and Brandon's friends to start searching. Brandon's friends, we believe it was three men, had remembered that Brandon had mentioned going camping someplace that they had camped with him before. So they had an idea of where they may have stayed. Those friends went to look for him. So what they did was they would get off at an off ramp, drive around, then get back onto the interstate and continue on until they found the truck.
Yeah, and there's not much out there. So like you can kind of scan the area pretty well. There's like camping spots that are a little off the road, but again, they were staying in the truck.
So they found the truck off Bumblebee Road in the remote part of the desert. In the back of the truck, they found that Lisa and Brandon had both been shot to death. So the friends flagged down a DPS officer, Ryan Hawkins. The way that they found Brandon and Lisa in the truck bed was that both of them were in their own sleeping bags, and they each had gun wounds to the head and the torso. Awful.
Scary.
Very scary. One of the first investigators on the scene was Lieutenant Frank Barbaro of the Yavapai County Sheriff's Office. Years later, he described the crime scene. He said that the truck was in an area that was used for parking for people who were typically going to go out riding their ATVs or camp. He said that the truck was backed in and it was fairly close to the road.
So you would think like kind of a concentrated area where people might have seen something, right? Like a parking lot of a campsite, you know? So investigators believed that they were sleeping, or at least they were getting ready to sleep when they were shot. Lieutenant Tom Boltz with the Yavapai County Sheriff's Office has done a few interviews in the last couple of years about this case. And he mentioned that there's evidence that Lisa may have woken up during the attack, but he didn't elaborate like why he thought that.
Yeah.
There were multiple gunshot wounds to both of them, so it definitely wasn't an accident. So I know I said, like, people go up there to shoot, but if it was a stray bullet, I feel like it would have been one, and it wouldn't have been, obviously, both of them.
Yes.
And twice, obviously. So murder-suicide was ruled out fairly quickly, as there's no gun in sight. So obviously the person left with it. To this day, the gun has never been found. And all we know about it is that it was a 25 caliber handgun, which investigators didn't release this information until about, I want to say it was 2020 in an interview, where they were on camera debating whether or not they should even include that detail, which I thought was interesting that they're like, they didn't really know what details they were going to release. And it was just kind of, I guess we'll say it now.
Yeah.
But according to authorities, it's a very small gun with only like a 10 or 11 capacity. So it isn't very popular.
I'm not a gun person. I don't know what guns look like most of the time. When you Google pictures of this gun, I want you to think like you are watching an action movie in the 80s and a woman pulls a gun out of her clutch, like her little clutch bag. That's what this looks like. It's so tiny, it looks like it barely would fit in an adult's hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's not a popular gun. Like, no one's really going to use that for anything real, right? Like, especially going out and shooting.
Yeah, it's teeny.
Yeah. There is no evidence of sexual assault. No drugs, no alcohol, nothing like that was involved that they could see. And investigators ended up collecting a disposable camera from the scene, and it was about 100 feet away. Lieutenant Barbaro said that it appeared to have been thrown from the truck. Now, it was broken, but they were able to recover the film in the camera and some of the pictures, obviously. So the last three photos are the ones that are especially notable.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll post them too, but two of which are separate photos of Brandon and Lisa in the back of the truck. Lisa's photo is her in the back of the pickup, and she's like sitting in one of the corners.
Mm-hmm.
And she's, the best way I can describe it is like she's leaning back and she has like jeans, maybe pants on. Her legs are kind of spread out. She looks like she's smiling, no shoes or socks on. And it just seems like an uncomfortable position. Like, I wouldn't take a photo like that. It just seemed kind of weird.
Yeah. And I would say, like, when we say that her legs are kind of spread, like she's got like, think like butt down, but like you're sitting on your tailbone, not on your butt. Like she's like, sorry, I'm like leaning back as I do it. Like she's leaned back in a way that you wouldn't normally sit in. And her legs are spread, but her knees are bent. So it's like in the central part of the photo is like the fact that her knees are bent. And like the way that she's leaning, again, it's not a way that you would pose for a photo. It is very bizarre.
It is. So like I said, she's wearing pants. She's wearing a tank top, barefoot for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she's smiling and looking at possibly whoever is taking the photo. So not the camera, but whoever's taking the photo, it looks like. Now, her mother, Paula, said in an interview, it wasn't her smile. It was like she was scared and she was smiling. Maybe someone told her to smile. To an unassuming person that doesn't know her, it does look like a smile.
It does,
but to her mom, she knows, right? Like, I can fake smile and I can real smile and the people around me would know.
And the smile doesn't reach her eyes. It's almost a grimace.
Mm-hmm.
When you really zoom in and look at it, you can tell that in her eyes, she's not okay. And her whole body is tense in the photo, too. Like, she's posed to look relaxed, but she looks tense. Because you can tell by her arms are engaged, like her muscles.
That's true. That's a good find there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just like, it's a bizarre way of sitting and posing. Like, it's just not a typical one. Even like early 2000s. You know how like poses kind of change with the times? That is not one then either.
I also just want to note that when I looked at that photo of Lisa for the first time, I got chills. I was just like, ugh.
I just sent her it blindly. I was like, this is the case we're going to talk about. These photos are connected to the case. I didn't tell her anything else until she started researching. So that was like all she knew.
Yeah. So this is just another bizarre facet of these photos is, okay, you and your significant other are camping under the stars in the truck bed. It's very cute. You're taking pictures of each other. You're going to what? Snap a shot. And then you toss the camera to your partner to take a photo, right? Like that's what makes sense. Also, presumably, it is nighttime. It is dark. It's not as though your position in the truck is going to necessarily matter for lighting. I don't know. I'm just thinking of, like, when you take a photo of somebody, like, unless there's a gorgeous view behind a certain area, you're going to stay where you are. Unless it's like a selfie.
Yeah. Agreed. Agreed.
Yeah.
Where Brandon took his photo is the exact same spot as where Lisa took hers. So instead of, like, tossing the camera, like Lindsay said, they seem to have gotten up and changed positions. And it's hard to tell exactly where it is.
Originally, we weren't so sure whether it was the front or the back. I think that it is the back. And the reason that I think that is because,
like,
one,
the tailgate, right?
Mm-hmm, like the tailgate is because, one, Lisa's arm moves back over the lip of, which you can see. But also, if you look right below her elbow, you can see where the key would, where, like, you would unlock the.
Oh, you're right.
But also the other part of it is one of the things that they have in the truck bed. It's called a Duraliner. It's like a liner that goes into a truck bed. And if you look at where the logo is, the way that it's oriented, I just pulled up pictures of it because I was like, I'm very curious about that. We for certain know that he's in the same exact spot because, one, you can see, like, the blankets and stuff, but also that Duraliner logo is in the same space. So it's not as though they just move the blankets to, like, the other side of the truck and it looks the same otherwise. Mm-hmm. All that to say, it looks like they're leaning against the back of the truck bed.
Right.
So in his photo, Brandon is wearing a long sleeve shirt and jeans, and he's wearing shoes. His arms are crossed, and he has more of this kind of, like, blank expression. To me, it looks like he's trying to school his fucking face. If someone looked at me like that, I wouldn't think that they were neutral in the situation. I would think that they were like, something is up.
Yeah.
The background of both photos are completely dark. And again, the way that he is also positioned is he's leaned back on his tailbone and his arms are crossed. His legs are spread with his knees up and the angle of the photo is straight up the middle of his legs. So, like, if you're thinking of these photos, one of the focal points, I feel like, is the seam of their jeans in the center, like between their legs. Would you agree?
It's strange.
And it's such a weird way. It's just, like, it's a weird photo composition. If Ben was like, let me take a photo of you like this, I'd be like, hey, what if you didn't? I feel like men, like, they kind of, like, spread their legs in photos all the time, whatever. It's not that big of a deal. But, like, women typically do not take photos with their legs spread in that way.
No.
But anyway, even the way that his feet are angled doesn't quite make sense. Like, they're kind of pointed outward a little bit. Not a ton. It's neither a pose nor a comfortable sitting position.
No.
Just very bizarre. So there's the photo of Lisa, there's the photo of Brandon, and there was also one more. And it is overexposed, which might be because the camera was thrown. But when you're looking at the photo, you can tell that it's taken of the inside of somewhere because you can see an indoor light fixture. You can also see vines. And when you're looking at it, it looks like you can see a window or a picture and what that would look like from the inside looking out directly behind the light. Mm-hmm. There's something on the wall. So you wouldn't see that on the outside in that same way. And you can kind of see the ceiling. So another reason to think that it was inside. But it's certainly at a very bizarre angle yet again. And some people think that the photo was taken from a building in Bumblebee that was a restaurant and bar in 2003. Many people theorize that when this photo was taken, Brandon and Lisa were already dead. However, from an interview with a local news station, it seems like it may have been taken before, as they said something about the last two photos being of the couple. But just to pull this back around, if this was the last photo, that means that the murderer would have had to take the camera somewhere else and return it to that area. Because, as we mentioned earlier, the camera was found near the truck, almost like it had been thrown from the truck. So it would have had to get back there somehow.
Exactly. Exactly. So I don't know about that, but perhaps they visited this area.
Mm-hmm.
My thought is, like, if they went here before they went camping or stopped there for whatever reason, maybe they talked to someone. Maybe they told someone where they were going.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they said, oh, we're going up here to camp. And they're like, are you now? But it's overexposed. So you can't see the full photo. You're only seeing, I would guess, like, the left side of the photo. And everything else is gone. Because when you're looking at the photo underneath the light, to me, it looks like that white smudge is maybe a shoulder and an arm coming up. Like, perhaps it would have been someone.
Oh, I could see that. In the olden times, when you had a disposable camera, one, don't we all miss the cranking sound? It's such an iconic moment. But you had a fixed amount of photos. I think it was like 25 or 30. So you are mildly judicious with the photos. I'm not saying that you weren't taking pictures of random shit, but it's certainly not like nowadays where I'm like, I don't want to forget that I need milk. I take a photo of my fridge. Or that's a pretty sign. Take a picture of a sign. I'm taking pictures left and right. I'm taking pictures like they're going to stop letting me take photos tomorrow. We're taking photos all the fucking time. That is not how it used to be. It used to be like it's a moment that you want to capture or a place you want a photo of. You would have to actively think, I want a photo of this moment so much that I'm going to take this camera that only has 30 photos. I'm going to take a photo of it and just trust it turned out well. Then I'm going to take that camera. I'm going to drop it off somewhere. Then I'm going to leave. Then I'm going to come back and pick those photos back up. Like, it was a whole fucking process. All that to say is that I find that it's strange that I just find it very, very unsettling. I find all overexposed photos very unsettling, though. It just, they always look spooky.
They do. And like, for this one, again, like, I think there is a light, possibly a window or something framed in the background. It looks like ivy from a plant hanging down into, I don't know, some sort of iron or something fixture, maybe. But to me, it looks like there's a person. Like, there's hair. The black part is the hair. The white is maybe a shirt, then an elbow, and then down maybe the shirt and the pants. Like, I think that that might have been a person standing there. And somehow that person is no longer there in this photo. And that is strange that that's the one that got, you know, overexposed and messed up when the camera fell. But also, like, I wish we could know, who is that? Is that Lisa? Is it someone else? Who did they talk to that day?
Yes. Now, the camera itself was purchased while they were on their way to the camping area that day. And they bought it at a grocery store in Scottsdale. Investigators were able to see the surveillance footage of them purchasing it. So they definitely know that it was from that day.
Yes. Yes. Now, when they looked over the crime scene, there were a few missing items as well. So the couple had brought a camcorder that Lisa's mom had also loaned them. Now, the camcorder was never found at the scene, but the case for it was. Detectives have described it as a VHS camera, and they know everything about it, including the serial number, but it has never been found. And it's weird because then you're like, what was on that camcorder? Why did they take that? But left the camera in the area, but they purposefully took the camcorder. But yeah, they took the whole thing. I don't know if maybe they were going to sell it or something.
Yeah.
Like, a camcorder would have been worth more than, obviously, like, a disposable camera is nothing to them.
Yeah.
But we don't know. We don't know why they took it. Another thing that was missing was Lisa's keys. So that's like, why did you take the keys? Police believe that there were more than 1,000 people staying in the area near the couple's campsite. And that seems like a whole lot of people for that area. So I don't know how close they mean, or if they're like in the neighboring towns, or I don't know. That seemed like a strange number to me. They investigated a lot of the people that were in the area that night when the murders happened, but all of them were there for like legitimate reasons. They were camping. They were, you know, going to ride their ATVs the next morning, various things. Now, strangely, in a different interview, a lieutenant mentioned that it was mainly a day use area and there wasn't many people around. There were people camping, but they would have been kind of away from the road. Like, again, that's like a place that you park and then you go off somewhere else to camp. So interesting. I don't know how many people were there or, yeah, what they encompassed when they said 1,000 people, or if they were just saying like the whole area in that desert, maybe. Just weird. But in my opinion, there probably wasn't a lot because it is just kind of the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, various updates have been given over the years. Lieutenant Tom Boltz mentioned that there were some new advances in what is being used to test evidence. So they're looking into retesting. There's also a new detective on the case that has been looking at it for several years now, and they're hoping new eyes might be able to find something that was missed back then. As of late 2023, they were working on genealogy, trying to get some information from the DNA that was at the scene to hopefully generate some leads, and they're working with 4 different labs currently.
I hope that they're able to solve it, though.
Me too. Me too. Boltz did mention that there were some persons of interest, and that they have interviewed and investigated in the past. And it kind of sounds like they're still looking into some people, though. But he wasn't very specific, purposefully, I'm sure.
So, Deborah West, a volunteer cold case investigator, has devoted many hours to this case since 2017. And she's working with a detective to re-interview everyone connected to the case. She's hoping that maybe someone remembers something or feels like they can talk about something now that they couldn't years ago. She's also hoping to test Brandon's pants, as the person responsible may have searched them.
Right.
Thinking of, oh, I'm going to steal something from him. I'll take his wallet or what have you.
And Lisa's keys were gone. I don't know where she kept the keys. So.
Exactly.
Interesting.
One of the things that we thought was really strange was that, so her keys are gone. I would assume if you were taking someone's keys, there would be a reason. And I would be very curious as to whether they searched their apartment afterwards for clues of someone going there to steal things or to take something, because that's where my head goes, is right? It's like, if you're going to take something, it's either a trophy or there's some type of evidence on it or there's a purpose. But I would just be very curious as to whether they searched Brandon and Lisa's home and what they found if they did.
Oh, interesting. I considered the keys, maybe like she put her mom's car key on with her keys and for some reason they took that, but not the truck. I don't know. I don't know why.
Yeah. Yeah. I just immediately go to, well, why would you want their keys? It's also one of the things that people like when you are robbed, for example, or if someone steals your car keys. The concern is not just that they have your car keys. It's also that they now presumably have the key to your home. And that just makes me very scared, very uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But getting back to what was going on, as far as DNA goes, they have had several matches in the area with people. But however, law enforcement wasn't open with what was tested. But as of a few years ago, because that's when the most recent information was released, all of the DNA that was found near or around the crime scene, there wasn't a legitimate reason for it being out there. So they're revisiting these interviews. They're still doing testing from what we know, but it's a little bit unclear as to what's ongoing with the case because the interviews with law enforcement were a year or more older.
Yeah.
Now, Lieutenant Barbaro, who we mentioned earlier, has said that usually when someone is killed, it's by someone they know. But he says that this seems a little bit more random, and he theorizes that it may have been a burglary and that the person didn't know two people were sleeping in the back of the truck. We'll talk more about that in a moment. Yavapai Style Witness is offering up to $10,000 as a cash reward for information that leads to an arrest in this case.
And that's been going on for a while, and unfortunately nothing's come of it. Now, a little while after her daughter's murder, Paula asked an investigator if she could have some of her daughter's personal effects. That's fair. She's like, I want whatever my daughter had with her, right? She was told that they couldn't release them until 25 years have passed or when the case was solved. She did not believe it was going to take that long, which, like, why would you, right? You're like,
yeah,
they're working on it. They're going to get him.
As much as it sucks, it does make sense.
Yeah.
Because you want justice for your child. If it's something that could be related to the case, I feel like waiting is the best way. But
yeah,
I would also be very curious if they showed her the items to be like, are these all Lisa's?
Oh, yeah.
Because I'm always curious about like what someone has on them. What does it match? Maybe they have keys that are not theirs. Maybe they have, I don't know, gum, right? Like if I died and I had a pack of gum in my pocket that had aspartame in it, you can guarantee that wasn't mine.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff where it's like you wouldn't know it was bizarre unless you knew that person. And you can be a great investigator all you want, but you don't know them like the family does. But anyway, I would be curious as to whether they did that. If you're thinking 2003. So I feel like in the 90s, Law and Order, we watched it. We loved it. It was great. It's still going. But I feel like in the early 2000s, there was like this influx of police procedural dramas. There's like CSI and all those. Maybe it was a little bit later, but I'm pretty sure it was right around then. So we're watching all of these crime shows where it's like criminals can't hide. We're solving every crime. We're solving every murder. And I think that public opinion really was you can't get away with murder.
Yeah.
I think even today people are like, you can't get away with murder. And I hate that that doesn't seem very true.
No. No, there's still cold cases. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's still so many unsolved murder cases. Just too much unaccounted for murder. I don't like it.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of places having to work together, which doesn't always work. And then labs also are backed up a lot of the time. So even though they asked for something, doesn't mean that they're going to get it anytime soon.
Yeah. And as we have more and more technological advances, they're then retesting data from old cases. So it's not even though these labs are just filled with the current queue of like what's happened this week or last week or last month. It's what happened in the past decade where they could test it.
Exactly. Which sucks. I feel bad. But
mm-hmm.
So back to Paula. She didn't think it was going to take that long, which no one should think that it's going to take that long.
No.
14 years later, she did an interview and cried saying, "I just hope that this is solved before I go, before I die. I want to know who did it, but it could be that it's not going to happen because Lisa doesn't want me to know who did it." Sadly, as we were researching, I came across Paula's obituary, and she passed on November 29th of 2024, so last year.
I just find it so devastating that she wasn't able to get that. This particular detail made me think of Winnie Johnson, who was Keith Bennett's mother. We talked about her in the Moores murders, where she talked about how her son was the country's son. Like, everybody cared. Everybody wanted to find who hurt her baby. She held on to that as her purpose from that point on. It was like, I just need this so I can have peace.
Yeah. Paula deserved to know what happened. And she's no longer with us. So it just sucks. She was devoted. And she did so many interviews over the years trying to keep the case out there. And she loved both of them so much. She, in the interviews, would even call them my kids, which I thought was very sweet. You know, like,
yeah,
she was devoted to both of them. So, yeah, it just breaks our hearts that she didn't get the justice that she deserves for her babies before she went. Some of the family is still alive and they're still pushing for it, too. But it's been so long and there's nothing.
Agreed.
So let's talk about some of the theories that has been presented over the years. Mike believes that one or more of the guys that found the bodies, the friends, might be involved or know something. So he's very skeptical about them.
Hmm.
He says that one in particular stands out to him, but he never really gave a name. I'm sure that's purposeful, or, you know, the investigation doesn't want him to. But Mike said that the person was questioned and was even given a polygraph, but then was let go. He believes that the motive is that that person, that individual, wanted to be with Lisa.
Interesting. We talked about it in previous episodes, but just generally polygraphs are unreliable. They're not a good metric for trying to suss out information.
No, no. Now, at one point, there was even a fight about this individual possibly wanting to be with Lisa. I couldn't find specific details, but I did find one article that mentioned that there was some sort of fight. And it could be what Mike is referencing, but we're not 100% sure. But anyways, according to the article, Brandon was arguing with an unknown individual in a doorway of his apartment at about 10 p.m., a day or more before the trip. The description of the person that the spokeswoman for Yavapai County Sheriff's Office, Susan Quayle, said investigators were looking for a person that was tall, husky, white, possibly 40 years old, and was wearing a white t-shirt and blue jeans. The spokeswoman said, quote, "They're looking for information either from this person or about this person." But it was very unclear as to what the fight was, what kind of fight it was. Was it just yelling? Was there more? I know they said that they were kind of shouting, but there's not specifics as to why or if that's the person that Mike's referencing.
Yeah. Mike wanted to go question this person himself, but he was told the guy's home had been cleared out and he left town.
Bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, suspicious. Sus-fucking-spicious. Lieutenant Barbara was asked about this. He says that the individual moved to Washington, he thinks, and that they went and did a polygraph and cleared him. But, quote, "I wouldn't clear somebody just based on a polygraph." Same. When asked if the person of Mike's interest was cleared based on the polygraph, Lieutenant Barbara's response was, "Well, he was cleared by them. Nobody's cleared by us right now." When the interviewer asked, "Then by who?" "By Washington?" Lieutenant Barbara said, "No, by the detectives that were working the case with the YCSO. Lieutenant Barbara was asked if this person should be reevaluated and re-questioned, but he answered vaguely and said, "Everything's on the table right now." It does seem, however, that off camera, Lieutenant Barbara agrees that this person should not have been cleared.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Mike believes that the YCSO botched the investigation. And in an interview that was done in 2020, it does seem that the family believed that had Maricopa County been brought in, the case would have been solved by now.
And there's more resources, I think, here, because I'm in Maricopa County.
Mm-hmm.
But further north, it's a lot of small towns, too, and like small areas. Like, there's Flagstaff and bigger areas, too. But where this was especially, it's very small and tight-knit. Now, interestingly, there have been several murders with a lot of similarities to Lisa and Brandon's. A few that we looked at have been solved. Luckily, I'm happy for those, you know, cases. But there was one that kind of stood out to me, at least. And it was one that happened 6 months after Lisa and Brandon's. And there were two men camping from Yuma up by Crown King.
And their names were William Middaw and Omer Casey. The men were shot and their pickup truck was stolen.
Hmm.
The suspect was tracked to Colorado Springs. And when he was contacted by police, he barricaded himself in a Super 8 hotel and then shot himself. Lieutenant Barbaro believes that this could be connected as there are similarities. And the suspect in William and Omer's case was a man named Rusty Rankin, and he was only 21 years old. He is being reviewed to see if he may be responsible for Lisa and Brandon's too. They have his DNA and his fingerprints, but none were found at the scene as of, you know, a few years ago when they updated the case. That doesn't necessarily rule him out, though. And they're still interviewing and trying to see if there are any other connections between the two. When they recovered Rankin's body, they also found 4 handguns in his room, but they didn't specify as to what handguns.
Hmm. Suspicious.
My guess is, let's say he was involved, or even a similar situation. Perhaps he saw the truck, opened the door, saw the keys were in there or something, then saw, oh shit, there's people in the back. They saw me.
Yeah.
And then left. And perhaps, I didn't see specifics on William and Omer's like camping situation, but perhaps they weren't in their truck.
Ah, yeah. But for the photos, I might agree. I think the photos add a different and more sinister level to this. There's crimes of opportunity where then you're like, fuck, there's a witness. I'm not saying it's okay. I'm just saying that the photos wouldn't have been taken. Couple things just to think about. In the photos, both Brandon and Lisa are blocking their abdomens. You cannot, like, you can see part of Lisa's, but the way that she's positioned, you cannot fully see her abdomen. And the same for Brandon. Secondly, tiny guns, right? We don't know a lot about guns. Again, we're not gun girls, but like, you can't shoot them very far. Those are close range weapons. So you'd have to be close. And it's a lot more of a personal murder to be very close to someone and shoot them, I feel like.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and it's true. There is no motive that was ever released for this case.
Mm-hmm.
It could be someone that knew them both. It could be a random person and crime of opportunity because it was in the middle of nowhere. It could be a theft gone wrong. It could be so many things. And it just, we're missing like that one more piece of evidence to like carve the path better.
I disagree.
Yeah.
I think that the staging of them in their sleeping bags like that, that's bizarre. Leaving them in the truck was a choice. The photos of them was a choice. Leaving the camera in a place that was in the perimeter of the truck was a choice. There is so much deliberate action in this that it does not feel like a random burglary. To me, it sounds like the work of someone who has, this is not their first, second, or third time killing someone.
Interesting.
This is 2003 when DNA is a thing and people are watching crime shows and they're like, look at all the shit that police can do.
Right.
And they still can't catch them. That just feels...
Well, I just feel like there's something missing as to...
Yeah.
Which person we should be looking at more, I guess. Yes, it does seem deliberate, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And like them in their sleeping bags, it could have been that they were ready for bed. It definitely mm-hmm. could have been that. And perhaps we're just misreading these photos. They are still bizarre to me.
Mm-hmm.
Still bizarre. But if we are just misreading the photos and they were asleep and someone just walked up, that could be. Or like I said earlier, maybe they met someone. And like, especially when you're camping, like I hate camping. I just feel like you're exposed and it's too much. But if they met someone wherever that other photo was taken and they said, oh, we're planning on watching the stars. How easy is that? No one's going to know you're in the middle of the fucking desert. Or maybe that person, whoever it was, if they met them, what if they're there? They're not in these photos, but what if they hung out with them?
I mean, yeah.
We've had kickbacks and stuff like in the middle of the desert in the back of a truck before.
Yeah.
I don't know. And it's strange that, I mean, it's very pitch black, right? Like there's nothing out there. So another thing that I think is kind of odd is that the photos that were released are black and white. And when you bought a disposable camera in 2003,
yes,
you could choose like, oh, I want a color camera or a black and white one. Like I've bought both before. I typically went with colored ones, but it's strange that they released them in black and white. I don't know if they are in color or if it, you know, because it was broken, they only could develop it this way. I don't know that. But I wonder if they could do more with the film now, like today with all the stuff that we have, to see if anything else
showcases. Another thing that caught my attention is for these photos, it doesn't look like it's just the flash doing the light to me.
I want you to go back in time with me, looking at the pictures you've just picked up after they've gotten. How often are pictures taken in the dark clear?
Not yes. often. They're not yeah. often.
To me, this is like there's definitely a flashlight
or a light of lantern or something, because it's a lot of light reflecting off the sleeping bag. Even
I went camping, like you'd have to have lantern is going to glow right around the lantern.
Well, like one of the, oh, I guess they don't have the big LED ones that we have today mm-hmm. either.
Yeah,
so
I know.
It must have been a work light even.
And in 2003, you wouldn't have had them in the truck. So they would have had to have brought that with them. And if it was a work light, it wouldn't be dead on.
Yeah, there's something.
When you look at them, it's like almost like they have a photography light on them because the lighting is so specifically angled at them. It's not from the side. It's not off kilter. It's dead center.
And it's weird. I feel like her lighting is better than his. Like he's more in the dark.
Yeah.
Like his face is more dark. And like for him, you could see a little bit of the side of the truck, but again, nothing behind it at all. And this actually interesting. I just noticed something else. Her picture is taken by someone that was also either in the back of the truck or leaning into the truck. The person taking his picture, they took it from outside the truck.
Yes, you can see more of the side.
Uh-huh. But we'll post these. If you see anything or anything stands out to you, we want to know because they are strange. Go back to 2003, your disposable camera game, and see. Like, I have a ton of pictures from that time.
Yeah.
I have boxes of them.
Mine are in Photo Bucket, who keeps threatening to delete them.
Oh, yeah. They're empty threats, okay? They've been threatening me for years.
I know. Don't delete them, please. I'm also not going to pay. I'm so sorry. They're just not quite right, mm-hmm. these photos. Like, even the way that her hand is positioned, like, her pinky is straight against the side of the truck, and the rest of her fingers are, like, dangling in a way that seems very bizarre.
Yeah, like they're the same photo, but completely different. You know, like they're in the same area, kind of a similar stance, but they just have like a different story to each of them.
Yeah, the stance is so similar that it's bizarre.
And I wonder, is that taken at the height of where Lisa would take a photo? Is it taller? Is it shorter? The way that it's taken? Because like for me, if I'm standing by a truck, I'm gonna have to hold it up more to get it. I'm short. I wonder if they've thought about that as well.
For this case in particular, it would make sense to have a forensic photographer, if you will.
Interesting.
Also strange. So much weird, weird stuff about this. Again, we will post the photos on our social media. And we just so thoroughly hope that there are more updates on this case and that law enforcement is able to do more DNA testing and that the person or people who are responsible for Lisa and Brandon's death are caught, because their families deserve closure.
Yes.
And they deserve justice.
Yeah.
As always, if there are any updates in the case, we'll share them in the next True Crime Digest that we do. If you have any cases you'd like us to cover, please feel free to reach out to us. We really appreciate you sending this one in, Nora. And then just as a little end note, a little housekeeping, if you will, we got some new reviews lately. Thank you so much for doing them. And if you leave a review and you haven't already reached out, send us an email with a screenshot of your review, because we'll send you a sticker. Also, be sure to send us your shipping address, because we aren't going to investigate you.
Yeah, I've sent a few out too lately. So again, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, we really, really, really appreciate all the things, all the reviews, all the love. And with that, have a great weekend.
Thanks for creeping with us.
Thanks for listening, and as always, a special thank you to our patrons who support us via Patreon.
Please see the link in our show notes to learn more about how you, yes you, can begin to haunt the dump, guard vortexes, or even become a scorching Sasquatch.
Ooh. Also in our show notes, you can find the link to our website, more information on our sources, our social media handles, and our merch store.
We'd love for you to keep creeping with us. So if you like this episode, please subscribe, rate, review, and share the show with your fellow creeps and/or ghosts.
I beg of you.